CD 9.
Forest, Monday, October 11th, 11:11 a.m. Kenner was 15 miles away, driving east on Route 47, listening to Sarah's radio. Her transmitter was still on, clipped to her belt. It was hard to be sure what was happening because each lightning strike produced a burst of static that lasted for the next 15 seconds. Nevertheless, he understood the most important point. Evans and Sarah had gotten away from the SUV, but the lightning hadn't stopped. In fact, it seemed that the lightning was following them. Kenner had been yelling into his handset, trying to get Sarah's attention, but apparently she had turned her volume down or was too busy dealing with what was happening in the ghost town. He kept saying, "It's following you!" over and over. But she never answered. Now there was a long burst of static, followed by silence. Kenner switched channels. "Sanyang."
"Yes, Professor?"
"Have you been listening?"
"Yes."
"Where are you?" Kenner said.
"I am on Route 190, going north. I estimate I am 3 miles from the web."
"Any lightning yet?"
"No, but the rain has just started here. First drops on the windshield."
"Okay, hang on."
He went back to Sarah's channel. There was still static, but it was fading.
"Sarah, are you there? Sarah! Sarah!"
Kenner heard a cough, a distant cough.
"Sarah!"
A click, a bang. Someone fumbling with the radio, a cough.
"This is Peter. Evans."
"What's happening there?"
"Dad."
"What?"
"She's dead. Sarah's dead. She got hit with a brick. And she fell. And then there was a lightning strike that hit her full on the body. And she's dead. I'm right here beside her. She's dead. Oh, shit, she's dead."
"Try mouth to mouth."
"I'm telling you, she's dead."
"Peter, mouth to mouth."
"Oh, God, she's blue."
"That means she's alive, Peter.
Like a corpse.
Peter, listen to me."
But Evans wasn't hearing anything. The idiot had his finger on the radio button. Kenner swore in frustration, and then suddenly a new blast of static. Kenner knew what it meant. There had been another lightning strike, a bad one.
"Sanyang!"
Now Kenner heard nothing but static on Sanyang's channel, too. It lasted 10 seconds, 15 seconds. So Sanyang had a strike, too. Only then did Kenner realize what must be causing it. Sanyang came back, coughing.
"Are you all right?"
"I had a lightning strike, very near the car. I could not imagine so close."
"Sanyang," Kenner said, "I think it's the radios."
"You think?"
"Where'd we get them?"
"I had them FedExed from D.C.
"Package delivered to you personally?"
"No, to the motel. The owner gave it to me when I checked in. But the box was sealed."
"Throw your radio away," Kenner said.
"There's no cellular net. We won't be in
Nothing more. Just a blast of static.
"Peter!"
There was no answer. Only silence on the radio. Not even static now.
"Peter, answer me! Peter, are you there?"
Nothing. Dead. Kenner waited a few moments. There was no answer from Evans. The first drops of rain splashed on Kenner's windshield. He rolled down his window and threw his radio away. It bounced on the pavement and went into the grass on the other side of the road. Kenner had gone another 100 yards down the road when a bolt of lightning crashed down behind him on the opposite side of the road. It was the radios, all right. Somebody had gotten to the radios. In D.C. or in Arizona? It was hard to know for sure, but at this point it didn't matter. Their carefully coordinated plan was now impossible to carry out. The situation was suddenly very dangerous. They had planned to hit all 3 rocket arrays at the same time. That would not happen now. Of course, Kenner could still hit his array. If Sanyang was still alive, he might get to the 2nd array. But their attack would not be coordinated. If one of them were later than the other, the second rocket team would have been informed by radio and would be waiting with guns ready. Kenner had no doubt about that. And Sarah and Evans were either dead or unable to function. Their car was broken down. Certainly they would never make it to the third array. So just one rocket array taken out. Maybe two. Would that be enough? Maybe, he thought. Kenner looked at the road ahead, a pale strip under dark skies. He did not think about whether his friends were alive or not. Perhaps all three were dead. But if Kenner did not stop the storm, there would be hundreds dead. Children, families, paper plates in the mud, while the searchers dug out the bodies. Somehow he had to stop it. He drove forward into the storm. McKinley, Monday, October 11th, 11:29 a.m.
Mommy, Mommy, Brad hit me. Mommy, make him stop.
All right, kids. Bradley, how many times do I have to tell you, leave your sister alone? Standing to one side of McKinley Park, Trooper Miguel Rodriguez of the Arizona Highway Patrol stood by his car and watched the picnic in progress. It was now 11:30 in the morning, and the kids were getting hungry. They were starting to fight. All around the park, barbecues were going, the smoke rising to an ever-darkening sky. Some of the parents looked upward with concern, but nobody was leaving the park. And the rain hadn't started here, even though they had heard the crack of lightning and the rumble of thunder a few miles to the north. Rodriguez glanced at the bullhorn resting on the seat of his car. For the last half hour, he had waited impatiently for the radio call from Agent Kenner, telling him to clear the park. But the call hadn't yet come. And Agent Kenner had given him explicit instructions. Do not clear McKinley Park before he was given the word. Trooper Rodriguez didn't understand why it was necessary to wait. But Kenner had been insistent. He said it was a matter of national security. Rodriguez didn't understand that either. How was a damn picnic in a park a matter of national security? But he knew an order when he heard one. So Rodriguez waited, impatient and uneasy, and watched the sky. Even when he heard the Weather Service announce a flash flood advisory for the eastern counties, from Kayenta to Two Guns to Camp Payson, an area that included McKinley, Rodriguez still waited. He could not know that the radio call he was waiting for would never come. Auroraville, Monday, October 11th, 11:40 a.m. In retrospect, what saved Peter Evans was the slight tingling he had felt, holding the radio in his sweating palm. In the minutes before, Evans had realized that something was causing the lightning to follow them wherever they went. He didn't know any science, but assumed it must be something metallic or electronic. Talking to Kenner, he had felt the faint electric tingle from the handset, and on an impulse, he had flung it across the room. It landed against a large iron vice-like contraption that looked like a bear trap. The lightning crashed down a moment later, glaring white and roaring, and Evans threw himself flat across Sarah's dead body. Lying there, dizzy with fear, his ears ringing from the blast, he thought for a moment that he felt some movement from her body beneath him. He got up quickly and began to cough. The room was full of smoke. The opposite wall was on fire. The flame still small, but already licking up the wall. He looked back at Sarah, blue and cold. There was no question in his mind that she was dead. He must have imagined her movement, but... He pinched her nose and began to give her mouth to mouth. Her lips were cold. It frightened him. He was sure she was dead. He saw hot embers and ash floating in the smoky air. He would have to leave before the entire building came down around him. He was losing his count, blowing into her lungs. There was no point anyway. He heard the flames crackling around him. He looked up and saw that the ceiling timbers were starting to burn. He felt panic. He jumped to his feet, ran to the door, threw it open, and went outside. He was stunned to feel hard rain coming down, pelting him, soaking him instantly. It shocked him to his senses. He looked back and saw Sarah lying on the floor. He couldn't leave her. He ran back, grabbed both her arms, and dragged her out of the house. Her inert body was surprisingly heavy. Her head sagged back, eyes closed, her mouth hanging open. She was dead all right. Out in the rain once more, he dropped her in the yellow grass, got down on his knees, and gave her more mouth to mouth. He was not sure how long he kept up his steady rhythm. 1 minute? 2 minutes? Maybe five? It was clearly pointless. But he continued long past any reason, because in a strange way, the rhythm relieved his own sense of panic. It gave him something to concentrate on. He was out there in the middle of a pelting downpour with a ghost town in flames around him anyway, and Sarah retched. Her body rose up suddenly, and he released her in astonishment. She had a spasm of dry heaves and then fell into a fit of coughing. Sarah? She groaned. She rolled over. He grabbed her in his arms and held her. She was breathing. But her eyes fluttered wildly. She didn't seem to be conscious. Sarah, come on! She was coughing, her body shaking. He wondered if she was choking to death. Sarah! She shook her head, as if to clear it. She opened her eyes and stared at him. Oh, man, she said. Do I have a headache? He thought he was going to cry. Sanyang glanced at his watch. The rain was coming down harder now, the wipers flicking back and forth. It was very dark, and he turned on his headlights. He had thrown his radio away many minutes before, and the lightning had stopped around his car, but it was continuing elsewhere. He heard the rumble of distant thunder. Checking the GPS, he realized he was only a few hundred yards from the spider web he was meant to disrupt. He scanned the road ahead, looking for the turnoff. That was when he saw the first cluster of rockets firing skyward, like black birds streaking straight up into the dark and roiling clouds. And in a moment, a cluster of lightning bolts came blasting downward, carried on the wires. 10 miles to the north, Kenner saw the rocket array fire upward from the third spider web. He guessed there were only about 50 rockets in that array, which meant there were another 100 still on the ground. He came to the side road, turned right, and came instantly into a clearing. There was a large 18-wheeler parked to one side. There were 2 men in yellow rain slickers standing beside the cab. One of them held a box in his hands, a firing device. Kenner didn't hesitate. He spun the wheel of the SUV and drove right for the cab. The men were stunned for a moment, and at the last moment jumped aside just as Kenner scraped along the side of the cab, screeching metal, and then turned into the rocket field itself. In his rearview mirror, he saw the men scrambling up, but by now he was within the spiderweb array, driving along the line of wires, trying to crush the launch tubes under his wheels. As he hit them, he could hear thunk, thunk, thunk. He hoped that would disrupt the firing pattern, but he was wrong. Directly ahead, he saw another 50 rockets spout flames and rush upward into the sky. Sanyang was inside the second clearing. He saw a wooden cabin off to the right and a large truck parked beside it. There were lights in the cabin, and he saw shapes moving in the windows. There were men in there. Wires came out from the front door of the cabin and disappeared in the grass. He drove straight for the cabin, and he pushed the cruise control on the steering wheel. From the front door, he saw one man come out, cradling a machine gun. Flame spurted from the barrel, and San Yong's windshield shattered. He threw open his door and jumped out of the SUV, holding his rifle away from his body, then landing and rolling in the grass. He looked up just in time to see the SUV smash into the cabin. There was a lot of smoke and shouting. San Yong was only about 20 yards away. He waited. After a moment, the man with the machine gun came running around to the side of the SUV to look for the driver. He was shouting excitedly. San Yong fired once. The man fell backward. He waited. A second man came out, yelling in the rain. He saw the fallen man and jumped back, huddling behind the front bumper of the SUV. He leaned forward and called to the fallen man. San Yong shot at him. The man disappeared. But San Yong was not certain he had hit him. He had to change position now. The rain had matted down the grass, so there was not as much cover as he would have liked. He rolled quickly, moving laterally about 10 yards, and then crawled forward cautiously, trying to get a view into the cabin. But the car had smashed in the front door, and the lights inside were now out. He was sure there were more men in the cabin, but he did not see anyone now. The shouting had stopped. There was just the rumble of thunder and the patter of rain. He strained, listening. He heard the crackle of radios and voices. There were still men in the cabin. He waited in the grass. Rain dripped in Evans's eyes as he spun the wrench, tightening the lug nuts on the front wheel of the SUV. The spare tire was now securely in place. He wiped his eyes, and then briefly tightened each lug nut and turn, just to be sure. It was a rough road going back to the main highway, and now with this rain it would be muddy. He didn't want the wheel coming loose. Sarah was waiting for him in the passenger seat. He had half-dragged, half-carried her back to the vehicle. She was still dazed, out of it, so he was surprised to hear her shouting something over the sound of the rain. Evans looked up. He saw headlights in the distance on the far side of the clearing. He squinted. It was the blue pickup truck. Peter? He dropped the lug wrench and ran for the driver's side. Sarah had already started the engine. He got behind the wheel and put the SUV in gear. The blue truck was gaining on them, coming across the clearing. "Let's go," Sarah said. Evan stepped on the gas, turned, and drove into the forest, heading back the way they had come. Behind them, the burning building had been put out by the rain. It was now a smoldering wreck, hissing clouds of steam. The blue pickup drove past the building without a pause and came down the road after them. Kenner turned and came back toward the 18-wheeler. The men were standing there, holding the firing box. One had a pistol out and began firing at Kenner. Kenner accelerated hard, driving straight at them. He hit the man with the pistol. His body was thrown into the air over the top of the SUV. The second man had somehow gotten away. Kenner spun the wheel. As he came back, he saw the man he had hit staggering to his feet in the grass. The other man was nowhere to be seen. The staggering man raised his gun just as Kenner hit him again. He went down, and the SUV bounced over his body. Kenner was looking for the other man, the man with the firing box. He didn't see him anywhere. He spun the wheel. There was only one place the man could have gone. Kenner drove straight for the truck. San Yong was waiting in the grass when he heard the sound of a truck engine. His view was blocked by his own crashed SUV. The truck was behind the SUV. He heard someone put it into gear, backing up. San Yong got to his feet and began to run. A bullet whined past him. He dropped to the ground again. They had left someone in the house. He stayed low in the grass and crawled forward, heading for the truck. Bullets snapped in the grass all around him. Somehow they had his position, even in the grass. That meant he twisted, turning to face the house. He wiped the rain out of his eyes and looked through the sights of his rifle. The guy was on the roof of the cabin, barely visible, except when he rose up to fire. San Yong fired just below the roof line. He knew the bullet would pass right through the wood. He didn't see the man again, but the man's rifle slid down the roof as San Yong watched. He got to his feet and ran toward the truck, but it was already driving away, heading out from the clearing, a pair of red taillights in the rain, disappearing onto the main road. Kenner was out of his SUV and on the ground. He could see the last guy, a silhouette under the big 18-wheeler. "Don't shoot me! Don't shoot me!" the guy was yelling. "Come out slowly with your hands empty," Kenner shouted. "I want to see your hands."
"Just don't shoot."
"Come out real slow and..." A sudden burst of machine gun fire. The wet grass around him snapped. Kenner pressed his face into the wet earth and waited.
"Go faster," Sarah said, looking over her shoulder. Their SUV bounced in the mud, headlights jumping wildly. "I don't think I can," Evan said. "They're gaining," she said. "You have to go faster."
They were almost out of the forest. Evans could see the highway just a few dozen yards ahead. He remembered that the last section of the dirt track was less eroded, and he accelerated, heading there. And he came out onto the highway, going south.
"What are you doing?" Sarah said. "We have to go to the rocket field."
"It's too late now," he said. "We're going back to the park."
"But we promised Kenner."
"It's too late," he said.
"Look at the storm. It's already full blown. We have to get back to help those families in the park."
He turned the windshield wipers on full force and raced down the road in the storm. Behind them, the pickup truck turned and followed them. Trooper Miguel Rodriguez had been watching the waterfall. An hour ago, it had been a clear mist coming over the cliff's edge. Now it was tinged with brown, and it had more volume. The river, too, was starting to rise. It was flowing faster and beginning to turn a muddy brown. But it was still not raining at the park. The air had turned distinctly humid, and there had been scattered raindrops for a few minutes, but then the rain had stopped. A few families had abandoned their barbecues. A half dozen more were packing up their cars in anticipation of the coming storm. But most had chosen to ignore it. The school principal was walking among the picnickers, telling people the weather would pass, urging everyone to stay. Rodriguez was edgy. He tugged at his uniform collar, uncomfortable in the dampness. He paced back and forth beside his open car door. He heard the police radio announce flash flood warnings for Clayton County, which was where McKinley Park was located. He didn't want to wait any longer, but still he hesitated. He couldn't understand why Kenner hadn't called him. The park was located in a canyon, and there was every sign of a potential flash flood. Rodriguez had lived in northern Arizona his whole life. He knew he should clear the park now. Why hadn't Kenner called? He drummed his fingers on the door of the car. He decided to give it 5 more minutes. 5 minutes, no more. What worried him most at the moment was the waterfall. The brown tinge had put people off, and most of the crowd had moved away. But a few teenagers were still playing in the pool at the base of the fall. Rodriguez knew that rocks would come over the cliff any minute now. Even small rocks would have enough force to kill a person at the bottom. Rodriguez was thinking about clearing the waterfall area when he noticed something strange. Up at the top of the cliff, where the water came over the lip, he saw a van with an antenna. It looked like a TV station van. There was no lettering on the side, but there was a logo of some kind. Still, he couldn't make it out from this distance. He saw a cameraman get out of the van and take a position by the waterfall, crouching down with a camera mounted on his shoulder and looking down into the park. A woman in a skirt and blouse stood by his side, pointing in this direction and that, apparently telling him where to film, because he was turning the camera where she pointed. It was definitely a news crew. He thought, a news crew for a school picnic? Rodriguez squinted, trying to identify the van's logo. It was yellow and blue, sort of swirly interlocking circles. He didn't recognize it as one of the local stations, but there was something distinctly creepy about this crew coming here right as the storm was descending on the park. He decided he'd better walk over and have a talk with them. Kenner didn't want to kill the guy now huddled beneath the semi. No member of ELF had ever been captured, and this one seemed a likely candidate. Kenner could tell from the sound of the guy's voice that he was scared, and he sounded young, maybe in his 20s. Probably he was shaken by the death of his friend. Certainly he couldn't handle a machine gun very well. Now this guy was afraid he was going to die too. Maybe he was having second thoughts about his cause.
Come out now, Kenner yelled to him. Come out, and everything will be all right.
Fuck you, the guy said. Who the fuck are you, anyway? What is your fucking problem? Don't you get it, man? We're trying to save the planet.
You're breaking the law, Kenner said.
The law? The guy said contemptuously. The law's owned by corporations that pollute the environment and destroy human life.
The only one killing people is you, Kenner said.
Thunder was rumbling and lightning flickered dimly behind the inky clouds. It was absurd to be having this conversation in the middle of a storm. But it was worth it to get the guy alive.
Hey, I'm not killing anyone, the guy said. Not even you.
You're killing little kids, Kenner said. In the park. You're killing families on a picnic.
Casualties are inevitable in accomplishing social change. History tells us that.
Kenner wasn't sure whether the guy believed what he was saying, had been fed it at college, or was just distracted by fear. Then again, maybe it was meant to be a distraction. He looked to his right, beneath his own vehicle. He saw a pair of feet moving around the SUV and heading toward him. Oh, hell, he thought. It was disappointing. He aimed carefully and shot once, hitting the man behind the SUV in the ankle. The guy screamed in pain and went down on his back. Kenner could see him under the car. He wasn't young, maybe 40 or 45, bearded. He carried a machine gun, and he was rolling over to shoot. Kenner fired twice. The man's head jerked back. He dropped the machine gun and did not move. His body sprawled awkwardly in the grass. The man under the semi began to fire his own machine gun. The bullets were flying wildly. Kenner heard several thunk into his SUV. Kenner lay in the grass, head down. When the shooting stopped, he yelled, "Last chance!"
"Fuck you!"
Kenner waited. There was a long pause. He listened to the sound of the rain. It was coming down very hard now. He waited. The guy yelled,
"Did you hear me, you fucking asshole?"
"I heard you," Kenner said, and shot once.
It was a real desert downpour, Evans thought, gripping the steering wheel. The rain was coming down in dense sheets. Even with the windshield wipers going as fast as they could, he found it almost impossible to see the road ahead. He had dropped his speed to 50, then 40. Now he was down to 30. The pickup truck behind them had slowed too. There was no real choice. He passed one or two other cars, but they were all pulled over to the side of the road. It was the sensible thing to do. The pavement was awash in water, and whenever the pavement dipped a little, it formed a lake, or a rushing rivulet. Sometimes he could not tell how deep the water was, and he didn't want to soak his ignition. He gunned the engine to keep it dry. He didn't see any road signs. It was almost as dark as night out there, and he had his headlights on, but they seemed to make no difference. He could see only a few yards ahead through the rain. He looked over at Sarah, but she was just staring forward, not moving, not speaking. He wondered if she was all right. Looking in the rear-view mirror, he could sometimes see the lights of the pickup truck following him, and sometimes not. There was that much rain. "I think we're almost to the park," he said, "but I can't be sure." The interior of the windshield was starting to fog up. He rubbed it with the back of his arm and his elbow, making a squeaking sound on the glass. Now he could see a little better. They were at the top of a gentle hill, heading down toward... "Oh, shit!"
"What?" Sarah said.
"Look!" At the bottom of the hill was a 15-foot culvert, the road passing over a series of large pipes carrying water from a small stream. Earlier, the stream had been little more than a silvery trickle in a rocky bed, but it had broadened and risen so that it now flowed over the surface of the road, the water moving swiftly. Evans couldn't tell how deep it was. Probably not very deep.
"Peter," Sarah said, "you've stopped the car."
"I know."
"You can't stop."
"I don't know if I can go through this," he said. "I don't know how deep."
6 inches of water is enough to carry away a car.
"You've got no choice."
In his rear-view mirror, he saw the lights of the pickup truck. He headed down the hill toward the culvert. He kept his eyes on the mirror, waiting to see what the truck did. It had slowed as well, but it was still following as he drove the SUV down the hill.
"Keep your fingers crossed," Evans said. "I've got everything crossed."
He entered the water. It was whooshing up on the sides of the car, spraying up as high as the windows and gurgling under the floorboards. He was terrified that he would lose the ignition, but so far, so good. He gave a sigh. He was approaching the middle now, and it wasn't that deep, no more than 2.5 feet. He would make it okay.
"Peter?"
Sarah pointed ahead. There was a large 18-wheeler coming down the road toward them. Its lights were flaring. It wasn't slowing down at all.
"He's an idiot,"
Evans said. Moving slowly in the water, he turned right, moving farther toward his side of the road to make room. In response, the truck moved directly into his lane. It did not slow down. Then he saw the logo above the cab. It said in red letters, A&P.
"Peter, do something."
"Like what?"
"Do something!"
Several tons of roaring steel were coming right at them. He glanced in the rearview mirror. The blue pickup truck was still behind him, closing in. They had him front and back. They were going to drive him off the road. The semi was in deeper water now, roaring forward. The water plumed high on both sides.
"Peter!"
There wasn't any choice. He spun the wheel and drove off the road, plunging into the water of the rushing stream. The SUV nosed down, and water came over the hood, up to the windshield, and for a moment he thought they were going to sink right there. Then the bumper crunched against the rocks of the stream bed, and the wheels gained purchase, and the car straightened. For a thrilling moment, he thought he was going to be able to drive the car along the stream bed. The water wasn't that deep, not really. But almost at once, the engine died, and he felt the rear end pull loose and spin around. And they were carried helplessly along in the river. Evans turned the ignition, trying to start the engine again, but it wasn't working. The SUV moved gently, rocking and bumping against rocks. Occasionally it would stop, and he considered getting out, but then it would begin to float downstream again. He looked over his shoulder. The road was surprisingly far back. Now that the engine was out, the car was fogging up quickly. He had to rub all the windows to see out. Sarah was silent, gripping the arms of her seat. The car came to a stop again against a rock. "Should we get out?" she said. "I don't think so," he said. He could feel the car shuddering in the moving water. "I think we should," she said. The car started to move again. He tried the ignition, but it would not start up. The alternator whirred and sputtered. Then he remembered. "Sarah," he said, "open your window." "What?" "Open your window." "Oh." She flicked the switch. "It doesn't work." Evans tried his own window on the driver's side. It didn't work either. The electrical systems were shot. On a chance, he tried the rear windows. The left window opened smoothly. "Hey! Success!" Sarah said nothing. She was looking forward. The stream was moving faster, the car picking up speed. He kept rubbing the fogged windows, trying to see. But it was difficult. And suddenly the car gave a sharp jolt. And afterward, the movement was different. It went swiftly ahead, turning slowly in circles. The wheels no longer touched rock. "Where are we? What happened?" Together they rubbed the windshield frantically to get it clean. "Oh, Jesus," Sarah said, when she saw. They were in the middle of a rushing river, muddy brown and moving fast, standing waves of churning water. There were big tree branches and debris moving swiftly along. The car was going faster and faster every second. And water was coming in through the floor now. Their feet were wet. Evans knew what that meant. They were sinking. "I think we should get out of here, Peter." "No." He was looking at the standing waves of churning water. There were rapids, big boulders, sinkholes. Maybe if they had helmets and body protection, they might try to go into the current. But without helmets, they would die. The car tilted to the right, then came back up. But he had the feeling that sooner or later it would roll onto its side and sink. And he had the feeling it would sink fast. He looked out the window and said, "Does this look familiar? What river is this?" "Who cares?" Sarah yelled. And then Evans said, "Look!" Trooper Rodriguez saw the SUV bouncing and spinning down the river and immediately hit his car siren. He grabbed the bullhorn and turned to the picnickers. "Folks, please clear the area. We have a flash flood now. Everybody move to higher ground and do it now." He hit the siren again. "Now, folks! Leave your things for later. Go now!" He looked back at the SUV, but it was already almost out of sight, headed down the river toward the McKinley Overpass. And right beyond McKinley Overpass was the cliff's edge, a 90-foot drop. The car and its occupants wouldn't survive it, and there was nothing they could do about it. Evans couldn't think, couldn't plan. It was all he could do to hang on. The SUV rolled and turned in the churning water. The vehicle was sinking lower, and the water now sloshing at knee height was freezing cold. And it seemed to make the car more unstable, its movements more unpredictable. At one point, he banged heads with Sarah, who grunted, but she was not saying anything either. Then he banged his head on the doorpost, saw stars briefly. Ahead, he saw an overpass, a roadway held up with big concrete stanchions. Each stanchion had caught debris floating downriver. The pylons were now wrapped with a tangled mat of tree branches, burned trunks, old boards, and floating junk, so that there was little room to pass by. "Sarah," he yelled, "unbuckle your seatbelt." His own belt was now under the chilly water. He fumbled with it as the car rolled. "I can't," she said. "I can't get to it." He bent to help her. "What are we going to do?" "We're going to get out." The car raced forward, then slammed into a mass of branches. It shuddered in the current, but held position. It clanged against an old refrigerator.
A refrigerator?
Evans thought, that bobbed in the water nearby. The pylon loomed above them. The river was so high, the road overpass was only about 10 feet above them.
We have to get out, Sarah, he said.
My belt is stuck. I can't.
He bent to help her, plunging his hands into the water, fumbling for the belt. He couldn't see it in the mud. He had to do it by feel. And he felt the car begin to move. It was going to break free.
Sanyang was driving furiously along the upper road. He saw Peter and Sarah in their SUV riding the current toward the bridge. He saw them crash against the pylon and hold precariously there.
The traffic on the bridge was swarming away from the park, passengers panicking, honking horns, confusion. Sanyang drove across the bridge and jumped out of his car. He began to run across the bridge toward the car in the water below. Evans hung on desperately as the SUV rolled and spun in the churning water. The refrigerator clanged against them again and again. Branches stuck through the shattered windows, the tips quivering like fingers. Sarah's seatbelt was jammed. The latch was crumpled or something. Evans's fingers were numb in the cold. He knew that the car wouldn't stay in position very long. He could feel the current pulling at it, dragging it laterally.
I can't get it open, Sarah, he said.
The water had risen. It was now almost chest high.
What do we do?
She said. Her eyes were panicky. For an instant, he didn't know. And then he thought, I'm an idiot. And he threw himself bodily across her, plunged his head underwater, and felt for the doorpost on her side of the car. He dragged a 3-foot length of the seat belt away from the post and brought his head back up, gasping for air.
Slide out! He yelled. Slide out!
She understood immediately, putting her hands on his shoulder and shoving as she slithered out from the belt. His head went back under the water, but he could feel her getting free. She moved into the back seat, kicking him in the head as she went. He was back up above the water, gasping.
Now, climb out, he yelled.
The car was starting to move, the branches creaking, the refrigerator clanging. Sarah's athleticism stood her in good stead. She stepped through the rear window and hung on to the car.
Go for the branches! Climb!
He was afraid the current would take her if she held on to the car. He was scrambling back into the rear seat, then squeezing himself through the window. The car was pulling loose, trembling at first, then distinctly moving, rolling around the debris pile, and he was still half out the window.
Peter!
Sarah shouted. He lunged, throwing himself forward into the branches, scratching his face, but feeling his hands close around large branches, and he pulled his body clear of the car just as the current ripped it away, dragging it under the bridge. The car was gone. He saw Sarah climbing up the debris stack, reaching for the concrete railing of the roadway. He followed her, shivering from cold and fear. In a few moments, he felt a strong hand reach down and pull him up the rest of the way. He looked up and saw Sanyang grinning at him.
My friend, you are a lucky one.
Evans came over the railing and toppled onto the ground, gasping, exhausted. Distantly, he heard the sound of a police siren and a bullhorn barking orders. He became aware of the traffic on the bridge, the honking horns, the panic.
Come on, Sarah said, helping him up. Somebody's going to run over you if you stay here.
Trooper Rodriguez was still getting everybody in their cars, but there was pandemonium in the parking lot and a traffic jam on the bridge. The rain was starting to come down hard. It was making people move faster. Rodriguez cast a worried eye at the waterfall, noting that it was a darker brown and flowing more heavily than before. He saw then that the TV crew had gone. The van was no longer atop the cliff. That was odd, he thought. He'd think they'd have stayed to film the emergency exit.
Cars were honking on the bridge, where traffic was stalled. He saw a number of people standing there, looking over the other side, which could only mean that the SUV had gone over the cliff. Rodriguez slipped behind the wheel to radio for an ambulance. That was when he heard that an ambulance had already been called to Dos Cabezas, 15 miles to the north. Apparently, a group of hunters had gotten into a drunken argument, and there had been some shooting. 2 men were dead and a third was injured. Rodriguez shook his head. Damn guys went out with a rifle and a bottle of bourbon each, and then had to sit around drinking because of the rain. And before you knew it, a couple of them were dead. Happened every year, especially around the holidays. Flagstaff, Monday, October 11th, 3:04 p.m.
I don't see why this is necessary, Sarah said, sitting up in bed.
She had electrodes stuck to her chest and legs.
Please don't move, the nurse said. We're trying to get a record.
They were in a small screened-off cubicle in the Flagstaff Hospital emergency room. Kenner, Evans, and Sanyong had assisted she come there. They were waiting outside. She could hear them talking softly.
But I'm 28 years old, Sarah said. I'm not going to have a heart attack. The doctor wants to check your conduction pathways.
My conduction pathways? Sarah said. There's nothing wrong with my conduction pathways.
Ma'am, please lie down and don't move. But this is, and don't talk.
She lay down. She sighed. She glanced at the monitor, which showed squiggly white lines.
This is ridiculous. There's nothing wrong with my heart.
No, there doesn't seem to be, the nurse said, nodding to the monitor.
You're very lucky.
Sarah sighed. So, can I get up now?
Yes.
And don't you worry yourself about those burn marks, the nurse said. They'll fade over time. Sarah said,
What burn marks?
The nurse pointed to her chest.
They're very superficial.
Sarah sat up and looked down her blouse. She saw the white adhesive tags of the electrodes. But she also saw pale brown streaks, jagged marks that ran across her chest and abdomen, like zigzags or something.
What is this? She said.
It's from the lightning.
She said, What?
You were struck by lightning, the nurse said.
What are you talking about?
The doctor came in, an absurdly young man, prematurely balding. He seemed very busy and preoccupied. He said, Don't worry about those burn marks. They'll fade in no time at all.
It's from lightning.
Pretty common, actually. Do you know where you are?
In Flagstaff Hospital.
Do you know what day it is?
Monday.
That's right. Very good. Look at my finger, please.
He held his finger up in front of her face, moved it left and right, up and down.
Follow it. That's good. Thank you.
You have a headache?
I did, she said. Not anymore.
Are you telling me I was struck by lightning?
You sure as heck were, he said, bending to hit her knees with a rubber hammer.
But you're not showing any signs of hypoxia.
Hypoxia?
Lack of oxygen. We see that when there's a cardiac arrest.
She said, What are you talking about?
It's normal not to remember, the doctor said. But according to your friends out there, you were rested, and one of them resuscitated you. Said it took 4 or 5 minutes.
You mean I was dead?
You would have been, if you hadn't gotten CPR.
Peter resuscitated me?
It had to be Peter, she thought.
I don't know which one.
Now he was tapping her elbows with the hammer.
But you're a very lucky young woman. Around here we get 3-4 deaths a year from strikes, and sometimes very serious burns. You're just fine.
Was it the young guy? She said. Peter Evans? Him?
The doctor shrugged. He said, When was your last tetanus?
I don't understand, Evans said.
On the news report it said they were hunters. A hunting accident, or an argument of some kind.
That's right, Kenner said.
But you're telling me you guys shot them?
Evans looked from Kenner to Sanyong.
They shot first, Kenner said.
Jesus, Evans said. 3 deaths? He bit his lip. But in truth, he was feeling a contradictory reaction. He would have expected his native caution to take over. A series of killings, possibly murders. He was an accomplice, or at the very least, a material witness. He could be tied up in court, disgraced, disbarred. That was the path his mind usually followed. That was what his legal training had emphasized. But at this moment, he felt no anxiety at all. Extremists had been discovered, and they had been killed. He was neither surprised nor disturbed by the news. On the contrary, he felt quite satisfied to hear it. He realized then that his experience in the crevasse had changed him, and changed him permanently. Someone had tried to kill him. He could never have imagined such a thing growing up in suburban Connecticut, or in college, or law school. He could never have imagined such a thing while living his daily life, going to work at his firm in Los Angeles. And so he could not have predicted the way he felt changed by it now. He felt as if he had been physically moved, as if someone had picked him up and shifted him 10 feet to one side. He was no longer standing in the same place. But he had also been changed internally. He felt a kind of solid impassivity he had not known before. There were unpleasant realities in the world, and previously he had averted his eyes from them, or changed the subject, or made excuses for what had occurred. He had imagined that this was an acceptable strategy in life. In fact, that it was a more humane strategy. He no longer believed that. If someone tried to kill you, you did not have the option of averting your eyes or changing the subject. You were forced to deal with that person's behavior. The experience was, in the end, a loss of certain illusions. The world was not how you wanted it to be. The world was how it was. There were bad people in the world. They had to be stopped.
That's right, Kenner was saying, nodding slowly. 3 deaths. Isn't that right, Sanyong?
That's right, Sanyong said.
Screw 'em, Evans said.
Sanyong nodded. Kenner said nothing.
The jet flew back to Los Angeles at 6 o'clock. Sarah sat in the front, staring out the window. She listened to the men in the back. Kenner was talking about what would happen next. The dead men were being ID'd. Their guns and trucks and clothes were being traced. And the television film crew had already been found. It was a truck from KBBD, a cable station in Sedona. They'd gotten an anonymous call saying that the highway patrol had been derelict and had allowed a picnic to proceed despite flash flood warnings, and disaster was probable. That was why they had gone to the park. Apparently, it never occurred to anyone to question why they'd gotten an anonymous call 30 minutes before a flash flood warning had been issued from the NEXRAD center. The call had been traced, however. It had been placed from a payphone in Calgary, Canada.
That's organization, Kenner said. They knew the phone number of the station in Arizona before they ever started this thing.
Why Calgary? Evans said. Why from there?
That seems to be one primary location for this group, Kenner said.
Sarah looked at the clouds. The jet was above the weather. The sun was setting, a golden band in the west. The view was serene. The events of the day seemed to have occurred months before, years before. She looked down at her chest and saw the faint brownish markings from the lightning. She'd taken an aspirin, but it was still beginning to hurt slightly, to burn. She felt marked, a marked woman. She no longer listened to what the men were saying, only to the sound of their voices. She noticed that Evans's voice had lost its boyish hesitancy. He was no longer protesting everything Kenner said. He sounded older somehow, more mature, more solid. After a while, he came up to sit with her. You mind company?
No.
She gestured to a seat. He dropped into it, wincing slightly. He said,
You feel okay?
I'm okay. You?
A little sore. Well, very sore. I think I got banged around in the car.
She nodded and looked out the window for a while. Then she turned back.
When were you going to tell me?
She said.
Tell you what?
That you saved my life for the second time?
He shrugged.
I thought you knew.
I didn't.
She felt angry when she said it. She didn't know why it should make her angry, but it did. Maybe because now she felt a sense of obligation, or... She didn't know what. She just felt angry.
Sorry, he said.
Thanks, she said. Glad to be of service. He smiled, got up, and went to the back of the plane again.
It was odd, she thought. There was something about him, some surprising quality she hadn't noticed before.
When she looked out the window again, the sun had set. The golden band was turning richer and darker.
To Los Angeles, Monday, October 11th, 6:25 p.m. In the back of the plane, Evans drank a martini and stared at the monitor mounted on the wall. They had the satellite link-up of the news station in Phoenix. There were three anchors, two men and a woman, at a curved table. The graphic behind their heads read Killings in Canyon Country, and apparently referred to the deaths of the men in Flagstaff. But Evans had come in too late to hear the news. There's other news from McKinley State Park, where a flash flood warning saved the lives of 300 schoolchildren on a school picnic. Officer Miguel Rodriguez told our own Shelley Stone what happened. There followed a brief interview with the Highway Patrol officer, who was suitably laconic. Neither Kenner nor his team was mentioned. Then there was footage of Evans's overturned SUV, smashed at the bottom of the cliff. Rodriguez explained that fortunately no one was in the car when it was carried away by the floodwater. Evans gulped his martini. Then the anchors came back on screen, and one of the men said, Flood advisories remain in effect, even though it is unseasonable for this time of year.
Looks like the weather's changing, the anchor woman said, tossing her hair.
Yes, Marla, there's no question the weather is changing. And here with that story is our own Johnny Rivera.
They cut to a younger man, apparently the weatherman.
Thanks, Terry. Hi, everybody. If you're a longtime resident of the Grand Canyon State, you've probably noticed that our weather is changing. And scientists have confirmed that what's behind it is our old culprit, global warming. Today's flash flood is just one example of the trouble ahead. More extreme weather conditions, like floods and tornadoes and droughts, all as a result of global warming.
San Yong nudged Evans and handed him a sheet of paper. It was a printout of a press release from the NERF website. San Yong pointed to the text.
Scientists agree there will be trouble ahead. More extreme weather events like floods and tornadoes and drought, all as a result of global warming. Evans said,
This guy's just reading a press release?
That's how they do it these days, Kenner said. They don't even bother to change a phrase here and there. They just read the copy outright. And of course, what he's saying is not true.
Then what's causing the increase in extreme weather around the world? Evans said.
There is no increase in extreme weather.
That's been studied?
Repeatedly. The studies show no increase in extreme weather events over the past century, or in the last 15 years. And the GCMs don't predict more extreme weather. If anything, global warming theory predicts less extreme weather.
So he's just full of shit, Evans said.
Right, and so is the press release.
On screen, the weatherman was saying,
It's becoming so bad that the latest news is, get this,
Glaciers on Greenland are melting away and will soon vanish entirely. Those glaciers are 3 miles thick, folks. That's a lot of ice. A new study estimates sea levels will rise 20 feet or more. So sell that beach property now. Evans said, what about that one? It was on the news in L.A. yesterday.
I wouldn't call it news, Kenner said. Scientists at Reading ran computer simulations that suggested that Greenland might lose its ice pack in the next 1,000 years.
1,000 years? Evans said.
Might.
Evans pointed to the television. He didn't say it could happen 1,000 years from now.
Imagine that, Kenner said. He left that out.
But you said it isn't news.
You tell me, Kenner said. Do you spend much time worrying about what might happen 1,000 years from now?
No.
Think anybody should?
No.
There you are.
When he finished his drink, he suddenly felt sleepy. His body ached. However he shifted in his seat, something hurt. His back, his legs, his hips. He was bruised and exhausted, and a little tipsy. He closed his eyes, thinking of news reports of events 1,000 years in the future. All reported as if it were up to the minute, important life and death news. 1,000 years from now. His eyes were heavy. His head fell to his chest, then jerked up abruptly as the intercom came on.
Fasten your seatbelts, the captain said. We're landing in Van Nuys.
Van Nuys, Monday, October 11th, 7:30 p.m. All he wanted to do was sleep. But when he landed, he checked his cell phone messages and discovered that he had been missed, to put it mildly. Mr. Evans, this is Eleanor in Nicholas Drake's office. You left your cell phone. I have it for you, and Mr. Drake would like to speak to you.
Peter, it's Jennifer Haynes at John Balder's office. We'd like you to come to the office no later than 10 o'clock tomorrow, please. It's quite important. Call me if for some reason you can't make it. See you then.
Peter, call me. It's Margot. I'm out of the hospital.
Mr. Evans, this is Ron Perry at the Beverly Hills Police Department. You've missed your 4 o'clock appointment to dictate a statement. I don't want to issue a warrant for your arrest. Call me. You have the number.
This is Herb Lowenstein. Where the hell are you? We don't hire junior associates to have them disappear day after day. There is work to be done here. Balder's office has been calling. They want you at the Culver City office tomorrow morning by 10 a.m. sharp. My advice is be there or start looking for another job.
Mr. Evans, this is Ron Perry from Beverly Hills Police. Please return my call ASAP.
Peter, call me Margot.
Peter. You want to get together tonight? It's Janice. Call me.
Mr. Evans, I have Mr. Drake for you at the NERF office.
Peter, it's Lisa in Mr. Lowenstein's office. The police have been calling for you. I thought you would want to know.
Peter, it's Margot. When I call my lawyer, I expect to get a call back. Don't be an asshole. Call me.
This is Ron Perry from the Beverly Hills Police Department. If I do not hear from you, I will have to ask the judge to issue a warrant for your arrest.
Evans, it's Herb Lowenstein. You really are a dumb shit. The police are going to issue a warrant for your arrest. Deal with it at once. Members of this firm do not get arrested.
Evans sighed and hung up. Sarah said, Trouble?
No, but it doesn't look like I will be getting any sleep for a while.
He called the detective Ron Perry and was told that Perry was gone for the day and would be in court in the morning. His cell phone would be off. Evans left a number for him to call back. He called Drake, but he was gone for the day. He called Lowenstein, but he was not in the office. He called Margot, but she did not answer. He called Jennifer Haynes and said that he would be there tomorrow at 10 o'clock.
Dress professionally, she said. Why? You're going to be on television.
Culver City, Tuesday, October 12th, 9:51 a.m. There were two white camera trucks parked outside the offices of the Venutu litigation team. Evans went inside and found workmen setting up lights and changing fluorescent light bulbs in the ceiling. Four different video crews were walking around, inspecting different angles, but nobody was shooting yet. The offices themselves, he noticed, had been considerably transformed. The graphs and charts on the walls were now much more complicated and technical-looking. There were huge blow-up photographs of the Pacific nation of Vanuatu, as seen from the air and from the ground. Several featured the erosion of the beaches, and houses leaning in an angle, ready to slide into the water. There was a school picture from the Vanuatu school, beautiful brown-skinned kids with smiling faces. In the center of the room, there was a three-dimensional model of the main island, specially lit for cameras. Jennifer was wearing a skirt and blouse and heels. She looked startlingly beautiful in a dark, mysterious way. Evans noticed that everyone was better dressed than at his first visit. All the researchers were now in jackets and ties. The jeans and t-shirts were gone. And there seemed to be a lot more researchers. "So," Evans said, "what is this about?"
"B-roll," Jennifer said. "We're shooting B-roll for the stations to use as background and cutaways. And of course, we're making a video press kit as well."
"But you haven't announced the lawsuit yet."
"That happens this afternoon, here outside the warehouse. Press conference at 1 p.m. You'll be there, of course."
"Well, I didn't. I know John Balder wants you there, representing George Morton."
Evans felt uneasy. This could create a political problem for him at the firm.
"There are several attorneys more senior than I who handle George's."
"Drake specifically asked for you."
"He did?"
"Something about your involvement in getting the papers signed to finance this suit."
So that was it, Evans thought. They were putting him on television so he would not be able to later say anything about the gift of $10 million to Nerf. No doubt they would stick him in the background for the announcement ceremony. Maybe make a brief acknowledgement of his presence. Then Drake would say that the $10 million was coming, and unless Evans stood up and contradicted him, his silence would be taken as acquiescence. Later, if he developed any qualms, they could say, "But you were there, Evans. Why didn't you speak up then?"
"I see," Evans said. "You look worried."
"I am."
"Let me tell you something," she said. "Don't worry about it."
"But you don't even know—"
"Just listen to me. Don't worry about it."
She was looking directly into his eyes.
"Okay."
Of course she meant well, but despite her words, Evans was experiencing an unpleasant sinking feeling. The police were threatening to issue a warrant for his arrest. The firm was complaining about his absence. Now this effort to force him into silence by putting him on television. He said,
"Why did you want me here so early?"
"We need you to sit in the hot seat again as part of our test for jury selection."
"I'm sorry, I can—"
"Yes, you have to. Same thing as before. Want some coffee?"
"Sure."
"You look tired. Let's get you to hair and makeup."
Half an hour later, he was back in the deposition room, at the end of the long table. There was again a crew of eager young scientific types looking down at him.
"Today," Jennifer said, "we would like to consider issues of global warming and land use. Are you familiar with these?"
"Only slightly," Evans said. Jennifer nodded to one of the researchers at the far end.
"Raimundo, will you give him the background?"
The researcher had a heavy accent, but Evans could follow him.
"It is well known," he said, "that changes in land use will cause changes in average ground temperature. Cities are hotter than the surrounding countryside. What is called the urban heat island effect. Croplands are warmer than forested lands, and so on."
"Uh-huh," Evans said, nodding. He hadn't heard about these land use concepts, but it certainly stood to reason.
Raimundo continued, "A high percentage of weather stations that were out in the countryside 40 years ago are now surrounded by concrete and skyscrapers and asphalt and so on. which makes them register warmer.
I understand, Evans said. He glanced away through the glass wall. He saw film crews moving around the warehouse, shooting various things. He hoped the crews wouldn't come in. He didn't want to sound stupid in front of them.
These facts, Raimondo said, are well known within the field. So researchers take the raw temperature data from stations near cities and reduce them by some amount to compensate for the urban heat island effect.
Evans said, and how is this reduction calculated?
Different ways, depending on who does it. But most algorithms are based on population size. The larger the population, the greater the reduction.
Evans shrugged. That sounds like the right way to do it.
Unfortunately, he said, it probably isn't. Do you know about Vienna? It was studied by Bohm a few years back. Vienna has had no increase in population since 1950. But it has more than doubled its energy use and increased living space substantially. The urban heat island effect has increased, but the calculated reduction is unchanged because it only looks at population change.
So the heating from cities is being underestimated, Evans said.
It's worse than that, Jennifer said. It used to be assumed that urban heating was unimportant, because the urban heat island effect was only a fraction of total warming. The planet warmed about 0.3 degrees Celsius in the last 30 years. Cities are typically assumed to have heated by around 0.1 degrees Celsius.
Yes, so?
So those assumptions are wrong. The Chinese report that Shanghai warmed 1 degree Celsius in the last 20 years alone. That's more than the total global warming of the planet in the last 100 years. And Shanghai is not unique. Houston increased 0.8 degrees Celsius in the last 12 years. Cities in South Korea are heating rapidly. Manchester, England, is now 8 degrees warmer than the surrounding countryside. Even small towns are much hotter than the surrounding areas.
Jennifer reached for her charts.
Anyway, she said, the point is that the graphs you see are not raw data. They have already been adjusted with fudge factors to compensate for urban heating, but probably not enough.
At that moment, the door opened, and one of the four video crews came in, their camera light shining. Without hesitation, Jennifer reached for some charts and brought them up. She whispered,
B-roll is silent. So we need to be active and provide visuals.
She turned toward the camera and said, let me show you some examples of weather station data. Here, for instance, is a record of the average temperature for Pasadena since 1930. As you see, Jennifer said, a dramatic rise in temperature. And here is Berkeley since 1930. A surprisingly incomplete record. But we are using raw data, so you can see missing years. And you see a clear warming trend. Indisputable, wouldn't you agree?
I would, Evans said, thinking that it wasn't much of a trend.
Less than a degree. Now here is Death Valley, one of the hottest, driest places on Earth. No urbanization has occurred here. Again, missing years.
Evans said nothing. It must be an anomaly, he thought. Jennifer put up more graphs. McGill, Nevada. Guthrie, Oklahoma.
These are stations from the Nevada desert and the Oklahoma plains, she said. They show temperatures that are flat or declining. And not only rural areas. Here is Boulder, Colorado. It's only of interest because NCAR is located there, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, where so much global warming research is done. And here are some more cities, Truman, Missouri, where the buck stops. And Greenville, South Carolina, and Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Evans said, well, you have to admit, it's not very dramatic.
I'm not sure what you would consider dramatic. Truman has gotten colder by 2.5 degrees, Greenville by 1.5 degrees, Ann Arbor by 1 degree since 1930. If the globe is warming, these places have been left out.
Let's look at some of the bigger places, Evans said. Like Charleston.
I happen to have Charleston. She thumbed through her graphs.
Evans said, so a bigger city gets warmer.
What about New York? I have several records from New York, city and state. Syracuse, New York, Albany, New York, Oswego, New York. As you see, Jennifer said, New York City is warmer. But many other parts of the state, from Oswego to Albany, have become colder since 1930.
End of CD 9.